Mr. Speaker, on this historic day, the House of Representatives opens its proceedings for the first time to televised coverage. I wish to congratulate you for your courage in making this possible, and the committee who has worked so hard under the leadership of Congressman Charles Rose to make this a reality. Television will change this institution, Mr. Speaker, just as it has changed the executive branch. But the good will far outweigh the bad. From this day forward, every member of this body must ask himself or herself how many Americans are listening to the debates which are made. When the House becomes comfortable with the changes brought by television coverage, the news media will be allowed to bring their own cameras into this chamber. In the meantime, there is no censorship. Every word is available for broadcast coverage, and journalists will be able to use and edit as they see fit. The solution for the lack of confidence in government, Mr. Speaker, is more open government at all levels. I hope, for example, that the leadership of the United States Senate will see this as a friendly challenge to begin to open their
proceedings. Under the rules, the gentleman's time has expired.
The marriage of this medium and our open debate has the potential, Mr. Speaker, to revitalize representative democracy.
Lovers of Congress history probably know who that was and when that was said. That's right, it was Al Gore, March 19th, 1979. The Democratic congressman from Tennessee, on the first day of live gavel-to-gavel television coverage of the floor of the U.S. House, and the first day of C-SPAN. Now C-SPAN is marking its 45th anniversary, and in this podcast, the weekly returns to Congress for that first day of TV. Not to hear more about Congress on TV. After all, you political junkies probably have heard that Al Gore clip before. But to find out something new, what else was said in Congress that first day of live TV?
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach, so no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
March 19, 1979, Democrat Jimmy Carter is president. It's the 96th Congress, and Democrats control both chambers. The U.S. House is called to order at noon. It's day one of live House TV, and Al Gore gives the very first speech. In the congressional record, his speech is titled, First Day of Televising of House Proceedings, a Historic Occasion. But, get this, despite the milestone, Al Gore was the only congressman who gave a speech on the floor that day about that historic occasion. There is one other passing mention, from Dan Lundgren, a Republican from California, in a speech opposing the creation of a new House committee. It had the name Select Committee on Committees. Congressman Lundgren said, with the new television coverage that begins today, perhaps such obvious congressional empire building will be seen by some of the taxpayers back home. But that was it. All the mentions of new live TV. There were other things to talk about, so climb inside our podcast time machine and transport back 45 years to that first day to hear what else was on the minds of other members of Congress in 1979, like Illinois Republican Henry Hyde.
The Foreign Operations Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee is withholding from public scrutiny an important report compiled by their investigative staff, which, if Jack Anderson is to be believed, is highly critical of some aspects of the international financial institutions, those repositories of billions of our citizens' tax dollars. I requested a copy of this report four times last week, but without success. As a longtime supporter of these programs, and as ranking Republican on the Banking Subcommittee on International Development Institutions, I can't and I won't participate in subcommittee authorizing hearings scheduled this week until I receive and have studied an uncensored copy of this secret report. Those who posture as guardians of congressional ethics and morality in government, those who trembled with outrage at the excesses of Watergate, ought to resist rather than perpetuate a cover-up on such a vital issue.
Congressman Hyde cited reporter Jack Anderson. Now here are two straight Republicans citing the Washington Post. First, you'll hear Robert Badham of California, immediately followed by Bill Frenzel of Minnesota.
As most of my colleagues in this body know, the House Administration Committee is in the midst of hearings on H.R. 1, the taxpayer financing bill for House general elections beginning in 1980. In testimony before the committee last Thursday, FEC Commissioner Akins labeled H.R. 1 ambiguous and virtually impossible to administer. This morning, the Washington Post added to the commissioner's comments by renaming H.R. 1 the Politician's Welfare Bill. The Post editorial clearly defines some of the major flaws inherent in H.R. 1. I quote briefly, "We repeat, in a Congress so touchy about fraud and waste and bureaucratic snarls, a bill that's so unmanageable would not have garnered so many supporters if it had benefited anyone else. Mrs. Akin's testimony should send the champions of public financing back to the drawing boards. Some other form of public aid for needy candidates may be desirable. This plan is not."
Here, the Washington Post, in its lead editorial this morning, described the bill to force taxpayers to pay for congressional elections as a politician's welfare bill. The editorial stated, and I quote, "The drafters of H.R. 1 proposed to dish out public aid to politicians willy-nilly, with few of the safeguards that Congress demands in connection with food stamps, student loans, or any other federal payments you might name." The editorial stressed the fact that prudent enforcement and auditing would involve more record-keeping, reporting, and federal inspecting than most politicians are willing to impose upon themselves. The article concluded by saying that the champions of public financing should go back to the drawing board. I can only improve on that by saying they should go back and stay there.
Now, here's Harold Volkmer, a Democrat from Missouri, talking about an issue we still talk about today, inflation.
Mr. Speaker, as I look at the mail and listen to the comments of my constituents, their number one concern is inflation. One element of inflation is excess government spending. And the people frequently mention the fact that the federal government should take the initiative in cutting back waste. In order to reduce government spending, priorities must be established and hard decisions made. Programs must be reviewed to find the ones that are unproductive, duplicative, and unnecessary. President Carter has shown leadership in this area of eliminating low-priority government spending. The President's 1980 budget proposal, which we are in the process of reviewing, reflects the need to restrict our spending and set priorities. In my analysis, I find the President has set realistic and attainable goals. Other areas of reduction can be found, but I believe the President's proposed budget is a good place to begin. Although we may differ as to what spending programs need to be reduced or eliminated, the President should be commended for his action. The President has made some difficult, sometimes unpopular, choices in his budget. In many instances, he has taken courageous stands. His initiative requires Congress to now address the problem of excessive government spending. By working with the President, we can succeed in reducing excessive, unnecessary spending.
Here's Representative Bob Carr, Democrat of Michigan.
Mr. Speaker, today I'm introducing a bill to place a limit on outside earnings of members of both houses of Congress. The Senate's recent action to delay their outside earned income limit is a slap in the face of the public. And equally important, it's a slap in the face of those of us who believe all members of both houses are equal constitutional officers deserving equal pay. According to decent politics, the public has a right to expect that important decisions such as this will be made in the open after full debate. The Senate's delay of the earned income limit was the opposite, a backdoor method of reversing a previously and publicly acclaimed decision. For these reasons, the bill I'm introducing today will apply the 15% salary limit on all outside income to all members of Congress, both houses. The bill contains some definitions and qualifications on this limit as the current, the same as the current House. rule.
Mississippi Republican Trent Lott.
Mr. Speaker, I have today introduced a bill which would give the responsibility of defining first-class mail back to Congress by defining the present regulations with minor changes. Let me emphasize that this bill does not seek in any way to repeal the private express statutes. The bill responds to a specific recommendation made by the Commission on Postal Service after its six-month study of the United States Postal Service, and I quote, "The Commission recommends that Congress enact legislation defining the scope of the present private express statutes. The legislation should respond to the need of businesses for expedited delivery of extremely time-sensitive matter and to the public interest in maintaining a nationwide postal system. It is this Commission's view that exclusions from the private express statute should be based not merely on the content of mail, but also in recognition of service requirements which the Postal Service is not prepared to meet."
And Earl Hutto, Democrat of Florida.
Mr. Speaker, today I am introducing a bill to amend the Food Stamp Act of 1977 to allow deductions for certain medical and dental expenses in the computation of income for households which are composed entirely of persons who are 62 or older or who are recipients of benefits under Title 16 of the Social Security Act. Under old regulations, medical expenses not covered by Medicare and Medicaid could be deducted from the beneficiary's income to determine food stamp eligibility. The new regulations, which went into effect on March 1, 1979, preclude the deduction of medical expenses. Not only in the First District of Florida, which I have the privilege of representing, but all over the nation, there are many elderly and disabled poor who have had their food stamps drastically reduced or eliminated. These people have been ravaged by inflation, by the soaring cost of medical and dental care, as well as costly housing. In many instances, these elderly and disabled must choose between dying from malnutrition or starvation because they cannot buy adequate food, or dying from not being able to purchase prescribed medicine. Lack of either will only compound their health problems, resulting in eventual death. I am certain that there are many here today who share my concern about the impact of the new food stamp regulations on the elderly, poor, and disabled, and I hope Congress will correct these ill effects. Thank you.
And finally, the Republican leader from Illinois, Bob Michael.
Mr. Speaker, this week our Appropriations Subcommittee on HEW will begin its hearings on elementary and secondary education, and as we approach these hearings, I hope we'll be considering the following. During the last dozen or so years, $50 billion federal tax dollars have gone to improve educational quality in elementary and secondary schools. The most recent surveys show that after an expenditure of $26 billion of these dollars on compensatory education, the best that can be said is that we should have cautious optimism about the ability of such funding to improve education. During the same period that federal aid has been expanding, so have federal regulations and paperwork and interference in every aspect of local schools. And during that period, we've seen declining test scores, violence in the schools, growing parental disenchantment, great inflation, and education union militancy. Is this what the American people have bought with their $50 billion? I think the time has come for the Congress to admit what the experts already have documented. Federal aid to education has not been all it was cracked up to be.
And now, a bonus clip. We open with Congressman Al Gore, 1979, the first day of C-SPAN, talking about the first day of House TV. And you heard him say, "I hope the leadership of the U.S. Senate will see this as a friendly challenge to begin to open its proceedings." Well, let's fast forward 7 years. The Senate meets Al Gore's challenge. June 2, 1986. The first day of live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the floor of the U.S. Senate, day one of C-SPAN 2, and here's Al Gore again, now a senator, and again on a first day of live TV.
The senator will be recognized for 1 minute. The senator from Tennessee, Mr. Gore.
Mr. President, Thomas Jefferson once wrote, "Our laws and institutions must move forward hand in hand with the progress of the human mind." 50 years ago, our executive branch began appearing on television. Today marks the first time when our legislative branch in its entirety will appear on that medium of communication through which most Americans get their information about what our government and our country does. The marriage of television and free debate in the Senate will be of benefit to the American citizens. It will bring changes in this institution. But whatever changes are due to the feeling that millions of Americans are paying attention to what goes on the floor of the Senate will, in the final analysis, be good and positive changes.
By the way, at the beginning of the clip, you heard the presiding officer recognize Senator Gore. Who was that? He's still in office, Republican from Iowa, Chuck Grassley. And like Al Gore, Senator Grassley was a member of the House in 1979 when Lifehouse TV began, which makes Chuck Grassley the only currently serving legislator who was in the House on day one of TV and in the Senate on day one of TV. And also serving in the Senate in 1986 when C-SPAN 2 began, current Republican leader Mitch McConnell. There is no one left serving in the U.S. House from that first day of C-SPAN in 1979. That's it for this episode of C-SPAN's The Weekly. A reminder, you could do your own searches in the C-SPAN video library. You can even look up March 19, 1979, the first day the House was live on TV, the first day of C-SPAN. And here's a neat trick. Watch the opening video and count how many speakers wore three-piece suits. At one point, four in a row. That's right, four straight members of Congress wearing vests. No doubt you'll find yourself saying about 1979 C-SPAN and 2024 C-SPAN, the vest is yet to come. For now, 45 years later, thanks for still watching, thanks for now listening, and happy searching.